طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This morning, our entire program will be devoted to hearing a report back from a trip to Palestine by Nancy and Hubert Murray. They were joined at this presentation at Boston University by Reverend Mariama White Hammond, but because of time restrictions, we will only hear from Nancy and Hubert this morning, and will air Reverend White Hammond next week, along with a very rich question and answer period. Nancy Murray has traveled to Palestine, Israel, some 18 times since 1988, which is why her observations and analysis are so well credentialed. She has led several delegations, including this one, as well as the first one I ever went on in 2001. Nancy is now retired, but for 25 years, she was the education director at the ACLU of Massachusetts. Her husband, Hubert, is an architect who focuses on environmental concerns. He presently is engaged in a project where he is designing a kindergarten to be built at the Lodge Center in the Ida refugee camp in Bethlehem. Here is part one of this unique report back featuring Nancy and Hubert Murray speaking at Boston University.
In November of last year, I co-led an eyewitness Palestine delegation to the West Bank and Israel. And as you heard, I've made many, many visits to Palestine since my first visit as part of a human rights fact-finding delegation in 1988, when the unarmed popular uprising of the entire Palestinian population, known as the Intifada — it wasn't the first Intifada, it was the Intifada — was 9 months old. How different things are today. In 1988, the small human rights delegation I was part of moved around and between the West Bank and Gaza Strip that had not yet been forcibly separated from each other and carved up by walls. Israeli-only bypass roads and hundreds of permanent checkpoints were not yet fully in place. And it was still possible to drive the short distance from the West Bank through Israel to the Gaza Strip, and the Palestinians of the West Bank and Gaza Strip could make common cause with each other. Israeli settlers numbered a fraction of what they do today. But one thing is unchanging, and that is the dehumanizing treatment of Palestinians by a brutal occupying force. More than 200,000 Palestinians would be arrested during the first Intifada, and more than 1,000 killed. In spite of that, everywhere we went in 1988, we encountered hope. Palestinians were convinced that their unarmed struggle would succeed in ending Israel's occupation, which was 20 years old when the uprising began. And everywhere we went, we saw evidence of America's involvement, from made in Pennsylvania tear gas canisters that caused at least 70 deaths and untold miscarriages during the course of the First Intifada, to the made in California billy clubs used to break demonstrators' bones. Now, the magnitude, by the way, okay, let's just go back for a second. So those of you who are familiar with the map, you will see in red the places we went on this second trip. So these are the places you're going to hear about from myself and from Hubert in a few minutes. We went from the very south, way up to the north, and I'll talk about some of that. Okay, so the magnitude of U.S. financial support for Israel over the years, $137 billion is the figure given in a congressional research report in early 2018. And the supply of U.S.-made weapons to maintain the occupation have grown considerably since my first trip. Now, this shows you, this is from the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights website, and it shows how much Massachusetts taxpayers pay every year. You can go to this page, click on a state, and find your share of that $137 billion. If you add it all up over the years, you'll see how much we have paid. This is just an annual figure. $128.5 million is what we pay per year. And just think of what that could do here in Massachusetts. So our aid, military aid now, to Israel has grown over the years, and so has Israel's illegal settlement enterprise. Back in 1988, parts of Jerusalem were flanked by settlements, but one could still drive considerable stretches in the West Bank without encountering them. Having observed the settlements multiply and expand over the last 20 years, I was still not fully prepared for the feverish surge in settlement construction and Israel-only road networks, the building up of those road networks, which has been turning the West Bank into a kind of biblical theme park. This has noticeably accelerated since my last visit 2 years ago, no doubt due to the Trump factor. That's an example of the carving up of the West Bank with the settler roads and the walls. But what we saw happening in the West Bank is going for broke Israeli colonization of Palestinian land and confiscation of Palestinian water resources, all of which is illegal under international law. And in keeping with the nation-state law that Israel adopted as a basic law, which is acts like a constitution, the basic law in Israel, so it adopted this nation-state law last year in which it says promoting Jewish settlement is a national value. So that is what it is now doing. It is seeking to impose settlements across the West Bank, seeking to impose the map of Eretz Israel on Palestinian land. Eretz Israel is the Greater Israel, is what it's called, a biblical Judea and Samaria, which is what religious settlers now call the West Bank and what they claim is a divine right. This is an interesting slide. It's an Israeli organization, Levi Ha'olam. The slide website is called Explore Judea and Samaria, and it was set up, it says, to support local Jewish business owners in Judea and Samaria who are suffering because of the anti-Israel boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. So when you click on these little hearts, those are illegal settlement businesses. So you can go find this website and look and see all of these businesses they say are suffering. They say are suffering because of the BDS movement. And this shows as well the extent of settlements. The blue dots are the settlements in the West Bank. You may be aware that Israel is an unusual state in that it has no fixed borders, and it never committed itself to specific borders during the so-called Oslo peace process that began 25 years ago. Since Oslo, the number of settlers in the West Bank and East Jerusalem has tripled to 750,000. And on February 4th, 2009, the Israeli government announced its goal was to settle an additional 1 million settlers in the West Bank, a number that officials have since then upped to 2 million. So they really are going all out now to cover the West Bank with illegal settlements. Today, throughout the landlocked West Bank, Palestinians are corralled into small enclaves by walls, watchtowers, military checkpoints, a road system that bisects the land but is off-limits to them, closed military zones, and omnipresent fortress-like settlements that glower over the rural landscape. On many roads, new signage points the way to settlements but omits references to Palestinian villages and towns that remain an obstacle to the full realization of the Eretz Israel vision. And large red signs tell Israelis that their lives would be in danger if they stray into these towns. Can you see what that says? It basically says this road leads to an area under the Palestinian Authority. The entrance for Israeli citizens is forbidden, dangerous to your lives, and is against Israeli law. And, you know, when Israelis actually do go in, they find they're welcomed in many cases if they go in with, you know, because they really want to understand what's happening. That sign is to really strike fear into the Israeli population. Most West Bank Palestinians can no longer enter East Jerusalem, which contains the third holiest site in Islam and used to be the vibrant educational, artistic, medical, and economic center of Palestinian life. All that has been destroyed by the wall that is snaking around and through East Jerusalem. When I first visited the old city of Jerusalem, the main gate to the Palestinian East Jerusalem, Damascus Gate, this is the old city's main gate, was teeming with life. It was where market women from surrounding villages sold their garden produce. The entrance is now nearly empty and sanitized as the apartheid wall has sealed off East Jerusalem from nearby fields and villages, depriving farmers of the ability to access what used to be their economic beating heart. So here, though, as this happened just in the last year, the apparatus of dispossession is tastefully displayed. You don't see those huge towers that you saw on the previous slide. Instead, for the sensibilities of tourists, you see this rather more modest tower, and there are two nice stone little army encampments near the old city gate. So Israeli soldiers with their weapons and high-tech equipment are now clustered in these stone encampments and one discreet mini tower, which, as I said, was just erected. They attract little attention from tourists who pose and take their selfies with the Damascus Gate as a background. All around us were signs of what Palestinians call the ongoing Nakba, with the Palestinian presence being diminished, if not erased altogether, through a variety of means, such as home demolitions. Some 44,000 houses in the West Bank and East Jerusalem have demolition orders, and they can be destroyed at any time. And 27,000 have already been destroyed since 1967. So they're living in this feeling of, you know, real insecurity. So that's one, home demolitions, the revocation of permits to live in Jerusalem. 15,000 Palestinians have had their permits revoked since 1967. And 35% of Palestinian privately owned land in Jerusalem has been confiscated to build settlements or to create national parks. So East Jerusalem is really changing. It's so dramatic since, you know, over the 30 years I have been going. As we drove around the outskirts of Jerusalem with the organization Grassroots Al-Quds, we saw where the U.S. plans to build its new embassy, which happens to be adjacent to an Israeli settlement. And we stopped at an overlook. Here's the overlook. Where we could see the settler highway running through what is called E1 to the major settlement city of Ma'ale Adumim. Now, E1, which you see here, this is all the only opening that now connects the north of the West Bank with the south of the West Bank. And Israel intends to basically get rid of the Bedouin who live there and expand the settlement so Jerusalem will be continuous to Ma'ale al-Dumim, and then you're in the Jordan Valley. In other words, cutting the West Bank in two. We see on the next slide here, this has been in the news quite a bit. Khan al-Ahmar, which is a Bedouin encampment, which they're trying to get rid of. There's been a lot of international outcry about it because people realize this is all that's keeping the West Bank from being chopped in two. That is sewage that settlers had dropped or had flushed through the village. This is one of the things they do. And that's not a nice little, you know, clean stream. Okay, I should point out that it is not just the stateless Palestinians of the West Bank who face expulsion from their land. We visited a Bedouin community in the Negev Desert, part of Israel. This is a place called Al-Araqib. These are Israeli citizens. And Al-Araqib is one of 45 what are called unrecognized villages, which have been there long before the State of Israel was formed, but have no water, no schools, no electricity, and do not appear on maps. Now Israel wants to remove them so it can, what they call, Judaize the area. And Sheikh Aziz Al-Tur told us his ancestors have been here for 500 years. He showed us Ottoman registered documents to prove this is their land. Al-Araqib, astonishingly, has been destroyed by the Israeli army 130 times since 1998. And the Jewish National Fund has planted water-greedy but swiftly growing eucalyptus trees in the desert, so they could no longer use their land to graze their animals. And when we were there, some of us in this room visited before when the trees were small. Now they're quite high and they get watered. A similar dispossession agenda is playing out throughout the villages of the 61% of the West Bank known since Oslo as Area C. This is home to 300,000 people. So it's playing out there. It's also playing out in the largest city in the West Bank, Hebron, where some 1,000 settlers are now implanted in the heart of the old city, turning it into a ghost town. And these settlers are particularly aggressive towards Palestinians. Just to make the point, the grave of Baruch Goldstein, who is a Brooklyn-born settler from Kiryat Arba, which overlooks Hebron, is a place of pilgrimage. Why? Because in November 2004, he entered Hebron's holy site, the Ibrahimi Mosque, and shot dead 29 Muslims at prayer and wounded more than 100. So he is a hero to the settlers of inside Hebron and on the Kiryat Arba, which overlooks the city. Since 1997, a multinational observer force known as the Temporary International Presence in Hebron, or TIF, had been monitoring said settler attacks on Palestinians in the old part of Hebron. But last month, following the leak of a confidential TIF report detailing 40,000 separate cases of abuse, Prime Minister Netanyahu ordered the TIF out of the country. And in the UN, the US blocked a draft Security Council resolution expressing regret at the expulsion of the monitors. The settlers now have the green light to complete their violent colonization of old Hebron. Palestine used to be rich in agriculture, but thanks to the various means that are being employed to impoverish Palestinian farmers and drive them from the land, today agriculture accounts for only 3% of the West Bank GDP. And let me cite a few of these means. Settlers frequently vandalize Palestinian homes and olive groves and attack farmers in their fields, often as Israeli soldiers stand by. The destruction of olive trees and fruit orchards deprives many Palestinian families of their only source of income, eventually forcing them to leave their land. Thousands of Palestinian farmers have lost their livelihoods to the $3 billion separation wall that cuts deeply into the West Bank. Many have been denied so-called visitor permits to pass through the locked gates to access their fields and sources of water that lie beyond the wall. Some have permits, but the locked gates are never opened. And if land is uncultivated for 3 years, it is considered neglected land, which can be seized by the state. So that's another means of getting rid of farmers. But the major method Israel has employed to destroy Palestinian agriculture is the weaponization of water. Since 1967, Israel has taken control of the West Bank aquifers and forced Palestinians to buy back their own water. Israelis use, by the way, 5 to 6 times as much water as Palestinians and 10 times more than refugee camp residents. So Palestinians' access to water is well beneath the minimum standards set by the World Health Organization, and for weeks at a time, water taps in villages and refugee camps run dry, while West Bank settlers routinely enjoy green lawns and swimming pools. In addition, Israel destroys Palestinian wells, cisterns, irrigation and sewage systems, and prevents rebuilding. In fact, in this month, they had gone on a real destruction binge in both the north of the West Bank, the south of the West Bank, and in the Jordan Valley, depriving thousands and thousands of villagers of water. Farmers are often prevented from storing harvested rainwater and cannot afford to irrigate their fields by purchasing at the high rates the water that the Israeli national water carrier called Mekorot has stolen from the West Bank. Now, practically everywhere we traveled to in the West Bank, we heard about a water crisis that has forced farmers off their land. And the picture is particularly stark in the Jordan Valley, which was once the West Bank's breadbasket. Now much of it has been sucked nearly dry by the 12 major Israeli wells and Mekorot pumping stations supplying Israeli settlement greenhouses and farms. Most of the Palestinian communities in the Jordan Valley have been declared part of Area C, where building of any kind is forbidden, and many existing structures have demolition orders. We visited the site of what had been a major Palestinian water source, the Al-Wujaf Spring. This is, again, in the Jordan Valley. So plentiful was its volume of water, you could see signs of when it used to cascade down the hill. We were told that people would come from elsewhere in the West Bank to gaze on the waterfalls carved into the arid landscape and have picnics on the banks of its mighty stream. Now no water can be seen, and the spring is totally dry. Nearby Israeli settlements and greenhouses are served by a Mekorot pumping station, that little blue thing there, that pumps 2,000 cubic meters of water per hour from a depth of over 1,000 meters. Palestinians in the Jordan Valley, including in the city of Jericho, are forced to buy their water back from Mekorot at a rate 6 times higher than the amount Israelis pay. Now, this pumping station may look fairly insignificant, but it is a fact, in fact, an engine of Palestinian dispossession and environmental devastation. It has increased the desertification of land, made it impossible for the Bedouin in the region to keep their flocks fed and watered, and killed once flourishing agriculture on Palestinian farms. And sooner or later, Israeli farms, too, are bound to become unsustainable as Mekorot pumps the West Bank aquifer dry. So what happens when farmers can no longer get their livelihood from the land? Now some 120,000 Palestinians, mostly with work permits, assemble at 3 a.m. at transit stations like this one, which we visited in Tilkarem, where they go through this dehumanizing cattle grid, or cattle pen, more like, and endure having their fingerprints taken on a daily basis, irises scanned, and sometimes their entire skeleton scanned, so they can do the dirty and dangerous jobs in Israel and carry out settlement construction. We witnessed, just in the hours we were there, reportedly 20,000 workers passing through this terminal. There are five others like it. We were told it could take up to 7 hours to reach a job in Israel. So once they get there at 3 or 4 in the morning, by the time they reach their jobs, it could be 7 hours later. After working all day, they pass back through the cage on their return journey around 7 a.m., and many spend hours then going home. Others who don't have permits cannot go through the terminals, but we were told, enter Israel by climbing over the wall. Now, as bad as all this is, the situation in the Gaza Strip is even worse. And you may know for a dozen years, the tiny Gaza Strip, it's right down there, tiny, home to 2 million people, over 70% of them are refugees. It has been a closed prison. So we could not enter Gaza. But the last time I did was in 2016, and it took me 6 months to get through the permitting process. We couldn't go there, but we did Skype with a young Gazan, Rawan Yagi. This is Rawan. And after talking with her, some members of our group were in tears. We could maybe talk later about the situation during the Q&A in Gaza. But what I want to leave you with now is the fact that the UN has reported that the Gaza Strip will be unlivable by 2020, if it isn't already, and that 98% of its water is not fit to drink. This is a very tiny area, only 26 miles long and 4 or 5 miles wide, where Israel has conducted 5 major military offenses since 2008, killing thousands of people, 800 of them children, and destroying homes, schools, hospitals, and the vital infrastructure for water, sewage, and electricity. And after each aggression, the Israeli-imposed closure has remained in place, blocking the import of much essential building material and forcing many people to live amid raw sewage and often in the rubble of their homes. Now, how many of you know of the Great March of Return? Yes, you've been watching it. Are you aware that it's still ongoing? It will soon be a year old on March 30th. Recently, some of us were fortunate to hear and meet Ahmed Abu Artema, who spoke at Harvard Law School. He is the organizer of the Great March, and he gave us a very clear picture of why the Great March was started, and again, we could talk about that in Q&A. In the early days of the Great March, it reminded me so much of the spirited, unarmed civil uprising involving women, men, and children I had first encountered in the Gaza Strip in 1988, for that is where the First Intifada began, on December 7, 1987. And in the years since then, it can be argued that Israel has been using the Gaza Strip as a kind of laboratory for field testing its new weapon systems and finding the breaking point of human beings. So terrible are conditions there that now that the Israeli historian Ilan Pappé, in his book The World's Biggest Prison, has called what is going on in the Gaza Strip incremental genocide. You might have remember Rahon Najjar, who was killed. She was a medic, and she was killed while she was trying to save other people. And these are some of the recent images. Let me conclude by saying that this isolation of the West Bank from the Gaza Strip, of one part of the West Bank from another, of one town from another, and of just about all West Bankers from the residents of East Jerusalem, this is a powerful deterrent to the kind of unified civil uprising of the entire society that I witnessed when I first traveled to the occupied territories in 1988. And you can get a sense of what that was like on March 26th. The movie, Nila and the Uprising, is going to be on PBS at 9 o'clock. So I strongly urge you to watch it. So it's different, but this does not mean there is no hope. On the contrary, Palestinians are still resisting and refusing to be dehumanized and defeated, as Hubert will explain.
Thank you, Nancy. And Welcome. I want to welcome Kate, who was with us on the trip this last November. So it's great to see you here again.
And Mariam.
And Mariam, of course, but Mariam was going to speak. And also to welcome my architectural and environmental and urbanist friends who are not the usual choir. So it's really great to see you here. Thank you for coming. And thank you, Nancy. Sorry to read all this, but there's a lot of material and a lot of unfamiliar names and places, so it's important for me to have written it down. I'm just going to remind you with this map and the next one of where we went, so you can sort of image Ramallah, Jericho, Jerusalem, Bethlehem, Hebron, and Nablus far in the north, just to give you a sense of where we're going as we go through this. I'm going to introduce you to many of the people to whom we were introduced during our 2 weeks in the West Bank. And these are people who are not just surviving in the difficult circumstances that Nancy's described, but they're persisting and prevailing against horrendous odds and resisting. I'm going to categorize these in, there are three bunches. There's agricultural resistance, cultural resistance, and political resistance. So to start with agricultural resistance, the Tent of Nations is a small family farm just a few kilometres from Bethlehem, located in Area C, which is 60% of the West Bank that is under the direct control of Israel. The Israeli strategy is to clear these areas of Palestinian inhabitants, as Nancy has been describing, achieving this goal incrementally by refusing building permits for any structure. 99% of permits have been rejected. Disallowing any natural water harvesting systems, e.g. collecting rainwater from a roof, and allowing the surrounding settlers to cut down olive trees and fruit trees and block access roads. All this and more has been endured by the Nassar family on their farm, encircled now by approximately 60,000 settlers, despite the families having clear legal title to the land, with documentation reaching back to Ottoman and British rule. The Israeli government is conducting a long, drawn-out and costly legal battle in the hope that the family will give up and leave. The Nassar family is not only fighting the government in court, they are determinedly farming their olives and almonds with support from volunteers, refusing to give in. Turning down blank check offers, they say their mother, the land that has nurtured them, is not for sale. As brothers Daoud and Daher each told us, they encourage visits by international volunteers to work on the farm, since that has proven to be the most effective human shield against attacks by the settlers. Because they're not allowed to build, they live and work in a series of 8 caves, one of which you see here on the bottom, and a handful of surface structures that may be physically or legally attacked. Their strategy is encapsulated, cast in stone, with the dictum, "We refuse to be enemies." You might just be able to read that on the top right corner. Daher explained that if a person starts to hate the people who are uprooting your trees, burning other trees and crops, that hatred can easily consume your life and being. And to quote, "With hatred, we will destroy ourselves." North of Ramallah is the village of Bilin, also in Area C. Bilin may be known to some of you through the film Five Broken Cameras. The curious title refers to cameras used to record the regular Friday peaceful protests against the occupation and the apartheid war. Cameras successfully broken by the IDF. After 14 years of Friday demonstrations organized and led by the Bernat family, they're now up to something like 20 broken cameras. The dirt road approach to the Yom Sleiman farm is littered with tear gas canisters, which you see in a little inset there, and an 8-metre high, 26-foot concrete wall leading to the farm itself, faced on the other side by the vast and illegal Modi'in Elite Settlement, a dense European-style conurbation of more than 45,000 inhabitants, which you can see in the background over there. The Yom Sleiman farm is a CSA. Who knows what a CSA is? Community-supported agriculture. It's an initiative started by Muhab al-Alami in 2016. The land was initially annexed by Israel's occupation war, but after a series of weekly demonstrations on the ground and backed up by international pressure in 1997, Israel had to back off about 50% of that land, which was restored to its owners in 2007. One of those owners donated his restored land to the startup enterprise. The economic model is that consumers collectively invest in the crops raised and managed by Muhav and his colleague Mohammed Abu Jayab. They now have 30 participating families, 50 raised beds under cultivation, with a wide range of fruits and veg. The farm lives under constant threat of demolition, and there are 44 demolition orders in Bilin alone. But Muhav takes the view that food self-sufficiency is an important part of the resistance to the occupation. In his words, "We are here and won't give up. We are prepared to pay the price for freedom." Not widely publicized is the prohibition of fertilizers on Palestinian land on the grounds that it could be used for explosives. A beneficial result of this is that many Palestinian farms have resorted to true organic farming, and in that sense are ahead of many of their European competitors in the production of organic olives, figs, and nuts. Now I'm going to turn to cultural resistance. In 1948, the Nakba caused 750,000 Palestinians to be made refugees, 100,000 permanently displaced within what is now called Israel. More than 600 Palestinian villages were destroyed, not only physically, but erased from memory, with a changing of names from Arabic to Hebrew, and the ruins planted with trees to conceal the past. The Palestinian town of Lifta, which you see here, is just outside Jerusalem, and it was one of the few not actually demolished, but evacuated of its Palestinian families. The name has been Hebraized to Mei Naftoa. What was once home to hundreds of reasonably prosperous Palestinian families is now a ghost town. A ruin surrounded by high-density Israeli urbanization, officially proclaimed a nature reserve, and now gradually being repossessed by Orthodox Jewish Israelis who use the ancient spring as a bathing hole. Throughout Palestine, hundreds of villages have been destroyed, their inhabitants dispersed, and place names changed, a technique used by colonists as a means of fully taking possession. Anybody who's seen Brian Friel's translations know how the British did that in Ireland. Now, this fellow you see on the left here is Umar al-Kubari, and he's one of the founders of Zohrot, an Israeli organization dedicated to resisting this erasure of memory and place through mapping the hundreds of destroyed villages, as well as maintaining historical records, written and oral. And as Umar has written, quote, "Signs serve as a means of occupation, oppression, and erasure." He's sort of pointing this out on the sign here. "Palestinians come upon these signs and they feel helpless, made to understand that they're absent, erased. Zohrot, the organization, marks Land Day, March the 30th, coming up, with demonstrations and maintains a website with historical information of the sort that you can't see, you can't read there, a cultural resistance to colonial erasure. Now, the Dehesha refugee camp, south of Bethlehem, has about 13,000 inhabitants in about 1.5 square kilometres. The Leilac Centre is a grassroots organisation that invests in the capacity of youth so they can help themselves and their community, combining activism and professionalism. Naji Ali, founder and executive director, talked to us after supper on the roof terrace. "There is only one paid member of staff, all the others are volunteers, and it's a strategy designed to resist NGO dependency, as well as the occupation. Any young person is welcome to come for support on any matter. And there is a lot of art all over the walls, all up the staircases, everywhere. It's great." Moving on, the Laji Centre is located in Aida refugee camp on the edge of Bethlehem. This is where Yigal is from. Serving a population of about 8,500 in Aida and Alazeh camps. Aida camp, according to a 2018 report from the Human Rights Centre at Berkeley, No Safe Space, found that, quote, "the tear gas exposure was widespread, frequent, and indiscriminate, and that, quote, there were no safe places in the camp." The same report stated that Aida camp suffered the most intense concentration of tear gas of any place in the world. In response to this situation and the desperate circumstances in which young people found themselves, The Lajee Center was founded in 2000 and has developed programs for community health, for water treatment to make it clean and potable, for healthy diets, and the development of roof gardens, all in an environment where there is food insufficiency and no open space at ground level. Based on a successful music program for various ages and a new playground, Lajee is now in the process of developing a kindergarten for preschool children. The founder and director, Salah Jarma, is an unpaid volunteer, but the leader for each of the programs is paid a modest salary. Now, the last section on cultural resistance relates to street art. It's all pervasive, and as in revolutionary China or in Paris in 1968, Israel's separation wall is the background for posters and paintings and graffiti that are public newspaper, library, and gallery all in one. What you see from the few samples shown here is that some are quasi-historical and documentary, recording children killed in the struggle, villages destroyed, and olive trees uprooted, and others are commemorative and laudatory of those engaged in the struggle, past and present. And with that, we transition into political resistance. Art is also the medium for commemoration and compassion. In our walk through to Haysha camp, we were invited into the home of Abu and Hassan, the parents of Martes, a young man who initiated a demonstration in protest at the approaching death of his imprisoned brother. Martes was shot and killed by an Israeli sniper. His parents talked of the great gap that had left in the family, clearly in evidence, as we looked at the walls of the living room on which were hung mementos and images honoring and memorializing the slain son. Another brother, Hassan, came into the house as we were in discussion. He'd only recently been released from 9 years administrative detention, meaning without trial, and was at first highly suspicious of a group of Americans in his parents' house. Palestinians are allergic to the word USA, he told us. Whether the Democrats or the Republicans are in charge, we have been suffering from their system from the beginning until today. He told us that over 1 million Palestinians have been in Israeli jails. Almost every family has a son or daughter in jail. The existential pain and anxiety was made especially clear as he told us that on his release, he was warned by the Shabak, the Israeli Shabak, that he would either be rearrested within 2 months or killed. His choice. In addition to the personal, family, and community anguish imposed by the oppression of the occupation, he also talked of the political situation. Existing political parties are weak and ineffectual. We also heard, here as elsewhere, that a dependency on NGOs had created a sort of moral rot from within the community. BDS was considered an important tactic, but no more than that. The only way forward, he says, is through international solidarity with, for instance, black and indigenous peoples in the US and elsewhere, the intersectionality implied in mutual support. Individualism is breaking us, he said. We must get back to our collectivism. It will take sacrifices for the human to be free, but we want humanity to live. We then went to Nabi Saleh, north of Ramallah, so a little bit up the map, to talk with Bassem Tamimi, his daughter Ahed, and Lana Ramadan, a lawyer from the legal group Adamir. The village of Nabi Saleh is in Area C again, and has a population of only 500, all named Tamimi. They've been exercising non-violent Gandhian-style resistance to the occupation in general and to house demolitions in particular since 2009, when settlers backed by the army seized their water source. 4 people have been killed since the start of their demonstrations and about 400 arrested. Another 400 have been injured, 40% of them children. Israeli snipers aim to shoot at the knee. Bassem has been arrested and jailed countless times. Ahed, his teenage daughter, you see on the right, described her own experience of being imprisoned, of the callous indifference of her jailers, of her great appreciation of the solidarity of women in jail, and of her renewed determination to become a lawyer and to make connections with other struggles. In response to a question from one of our African-American delegates, her message to black youth in the US was, stay strong, you must fight for all the oppressed, not just for Palestinian rights. And then Lana Ramadan, who is the second from the right in that picture, she's the lawyer from Adamir, And represents about 6,000 Palestinians, many arrested and jailed for minor traffic violations, many administratively detained, meaning held indefinitely without charges and without trial. Charges, arrests, and imprisonments are noted for their capriciousness, a tactic used to keep the population constantly on edge. You just simply don't know whether you're going to be arrested or not. You simply don't know whether your child is going to come back home or not. Her message was, it would be easy to despair, but think of our head and her example of strength. We lose people and others get demotivated, but we don't have the option to abandon hope. Then the last visit to mention was to listen to Omar Barghouti talk about the current state of the boycott, divestment and sanctions campaign of which he is co-founder. In his historical sweep, he talked of the parallels with the boycotting of South African economic products and international cultural and sporting events. And three major points he made were BDS is gaining a lot of traction with the democratic countries, but none with authoritarian regimes. Netanyahu and Trump have managed to associate Israel and the Zionist project with some of the most abjectly right-wing regimes, e.g. Trump's America, Orban's Hungary, and Bolsonaro's Brazil. And then lastly, he said the affinities between Black and Native American movements in the US and the Palestinian struggle are strong and can be mutually beneficial in their respective campaigns. Now, this has, you know, necessarily been a very short presentation on the number of places we visited and the people we met and the issues we were introduced to and discussed. But here is a collage of some of those who I've mentioned, but many of those who we didn't have time to talk about. We met farmers and teachers and students and trade unionists and grandmothers and lawyers, a doctor, community health workers, conscientious objectors, LGBT activists and others. We met Palestinians and Israelis resisting the occupation by fighting for land rights, water rights, rights to food, demanding freedom of movement, freedom from arrest, freedom to live, freedom from occupation. And the question you have to ask is, why do these people tolerate talking to Americans when it's the United States that is the supporter and enabler of Israel in their oppression? Time and again, we found that Palestinians can readily distinguish regular Americans, including Jewish Americans, from their government. Quite apart from the human contact, they see it as worthwhile to invest in talking, in representing their case, relying on our ability to represent their case to our neighbours and colleagues and elected representatives, i.e. you. As Omar Barghouti and others repeatedly point out, all they're asking for is that Palestinians should enjoy freedom, justice and equal rights, just like anyone else.
You have been listening to Nancy and Hubert Murray doing a report back on their trip to Palestine at Boston University. Before we go, we want to give you an opportunity to speak out for water rights in Palestine by joining the World Water Day standout on Friday, March 22nd, that is this coming Friday, at 4:30 p.m. at the BU Bridge. There will be a standout at both the Boston and Cambridge sides of the BU Bridge, but this is your opportunity to do something about water inequality. Again, the standout is this coming Friday, March 22nd, at 4:30 p.m., rush hour, at both sides of the BU Bridge. Choose your side. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. And this is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.